Hi, and welcome to Nonprofits. It's Wednesday, September 20th. My name is Robert.
I'm Atif.
I'm Scott.
Our guest today is super forecaster Welton Chang. Welton is a PhD candidate in psychology at Penn in Phil Tetlock and Barb Meller's Good Judgment Lab, where he studies how accountability systems affect judgments. And hopefully he'll be able to explain to us in great detail what exactly that means. Welton also has master's degrees in both security studies and in psychology, and is a former U.S. Army intelligence officer who served in both Iraq and South Korea. And Welton has two Instagram famous cats. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Welton.
Thanks, and thanks for giving my cats a shout out. I'm sure they appreciate it.
Well, they're like Katie Kardashians.
Don't inflate their egos more than they need it.
They're going to listen to the podcast, I hope.
I heard that they, you know, basically think that they're better than this, so.
Yeah, they probably are.
Yeah, that's every cat.
Well, can you tell us how you got involved? You're actually working in the Good Judgment Lab now. How did you get involved in the Good Judgment Project and in forecasting in general?
Yeah, so I actually got an email from a friend and mentor at Dartmouth, where I did my undergrad. And it said that the Good Judgment Project, this was back in 2011, was recruiting people to join as forecasters. And from that, I looked at that email and said, hey, this is something that I might want to get involved in. And I was in Baghdad at the time. I was on my second deployment working for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And forecasting was always something that I had somewhat of an interest in. I had read Phil's book, Expert Political Judgment, back in 2006 when I was stationed in Korea. And it left a real deep impression on how I look at the world. So from there, things just kind of snowballed. I got home from Baghdad, did more and more forecasting. In the first year, I think what I basically tried to do was to look at the questions that were posed in order to come up with a decent forecast for things. And at the end of that year, I was informed that I was in the top whatever percent of people and had qualified to be a quote-unquote super forecaster. And 6 years later, here we are.
So, but how did you get from there to the to decide to do a PhD work in the Good Judgment Lab?
I would love to say that it was intentional and strategic, but of course, life doesn't work that way.
Right.
I was, I think, just really interested in forecasting because of how it revealed how much or little we know about the world going on around us. It was always very interesting to me that there were a lot of people in the media and elsewhere who were not very good forecasters but could tell a beautiful story and were getting paid a ton of money to do that. Pretty much the entire New York Times op-ed page exemplifies this phenomenon. And from there, I think I just took an interest in psychology, and especially after reading Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. And I had the opportunity to go and talk with Phil when I went to Penn for one of the Super Forecaster conferences, and things just kind of evolved from there. Decided to quit my job at DIA and try to get a PhD.
You were doing military intelligence. Did you do any forecasting in that role, or is it something different mostly?
No, I never really did any kind of forecasting for my day job. Now, that's not to say that we didn't try to make bets on whether or not certain things would happen. For example, when I was in Korea in 2006, that was the year that Kim Jong-il launched the Taepodong 2 missile on July 4th. And I remember having my leave scrapped for that weekend. Quite unfortunate. We were on 24-hour alert because of this thing that was going to get launched, and was not too happy about that.
So you knew well in advance that that was going to be launched, or somewhat in advance.
I can't go into the specifics of that, but
sure.
We were making jokes about whether or not, you know, this was actually going to happen or not.
I think for public information that one was a liquid fuel rocket, which actually takes some time to load. So it's not like, and it was not mobile. So I thought, it, as far as I understand, and I don't have any classified information. So whatever I'm speaking is whatever I know or or whatever I'm just completely wrong about. But I thought like in earlier days is a bit easier to have lead time on those things. But there's a strange phenomenon that he's tends to like to launch things on specific dates. So like on the 4th of July, on around times that are important for North Korea, not just on whatever random day they happen to get something made and ready to launch.
And yeah, I have a digression about that because everyone says that, but I actually haven't noticed that pattern. I mean, the recent tests, were they on special days?
Labor Day.
But that's not a, are they, is that international North Korean Day? I mean, it seems like there are a lot of holiday special events in North Korea, but whenever they say it's, you know, Kim Jong-un's birthday or whatever, there's never a test.
I actually have to agree with you on that, Robert. I don't think that the pattern that everyone says appears in how they make their calculations and decide when to do things actually lines up perfectly with significant dates, whether they be U.S. holidays or otherwise. However, I think part of it is we tend to remember these more memorable, right, vivid events. And whenever it happens on a holiday, you remember that. So I do remember it was July 4th. And we were sitting around making jokes about whether or not it was going to happen. I happened to make a bet with some of my sergeants who had been working in Korea for longer than I had. I was a second lieutenant at the time, basically knew nothing. And they were right and I was wrong. And it got me started to think more about whether or not I could actually trust my judgments on what was going to happen in North Korea. And I think this extended to my first tour in Iraq, in trying to think about whether or not there would be an IED on a specific route, doing this kind of pattern analysis that's very common in military intelligence. And I think a lot of it also came from my soldiers basically, you know, coming up to me and using intelligence in air quotes because of how frequently we were wrong. So having to confront being wrong on a regular basis, you know, it's not like baseball where you can go to the Hall of Fame if you hit 3 out of 10 balls into play and get a hit, right? It's very much different in terms of the consequences of getting it wrong. And that's what got me thinking more and more about the nature of judgment, the nature of thinking and cognition, and ultimately the kind of foundational bedrock of our psychology.
But we don't have the option of being right every time. It's not like we can receive prophecies from Apollo. We are only, even super forecasters are only able to make marginal improvements over ordinary forecasters to some extent. But that could matter. A difference between knowing, you know, a small percent difference in knowing which are the most dangerous routes for IEDs could save lives if you reroute the convoy or whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
And I think it also just goes to demonstrate the limits of our knowledge and the limits of our ability to make sense of what's going on around us, whether that be as a result of random variables, some insurgent waking up on the wrong side of the bed and deciding, hey, today I'm going to blow up the next convoy, or just a convoy leader deciding to take a different route on that day, right, and you know, the next convoy over gets blown up ahead of them. These things are inexplicable, they're random, and no matter how much we love to talk about how great the supers are at doing this whole forecasting business, I think that people should be pretty circumspect in how they view this skill.
One of the questions though that I, or one of the observations that I have is some of the questions that were given to me seem like the answer, we're supposed to be working in what's called the Goldilocks zone of between 10 and 90. So if something is too obvious, then there's no sense, you know, wasting our time on it. Either way, you know, that's not going to happen, it's going to happen. But some of the questions to me seem like they really do fit into the area that the outcome is pretty easy to know. For instance, if you're talking about Middle East peace prospects with Israel, you know, pretty much the answer is usually no, with the exception of the, you know, the peace with Egypt. It's like, you know, there are very, very few times where anything comes to fruition.
Well, you know, Scott, not now that Kushner's in
charge. Well, I know that's going to change things. So you have to look at, you know, what's a real quantum change. But, you know, I mean, but seriously, it's like usually, you know, we have questions and people do spend time, and John Kerry and Obama spent time trying to make peace. And I think it was still a worthwhile effort because it had a period of time where there were lower hostilities, but the idea that all those sides would come together and reach an ultimate peace, I thought there were enough signs around it. This wasn't like the uncertainty of whether a person wakes up on the wrong side of the bed and puts an IED on one street or the other. So I feel like there are some areas where, like, we might say that our average score across 500 questions is X, but on some questions the uncertainty is very, very high, and on others I feel like we can nail it down pretty well. And I'm trying to figure out also how that advice could be given to people, so it's not just, yeah, we think it's a 70% chance, but yeah, we think we know with, you know, there, we have very solid reasons for believing this. It's not really just sort of coin flip. And I don't know how much that's communicated.
Communicate our uncertainty in some way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's all, really, really valuable kind of contextual things to go around the kinds of questions that we're being asked to look at. And for the most part, things in the world are difficult to do. They're just not a lot of things that are impactful that are easy. And as a result, you can bring the status quo and think about the status quo as something that's fairly sticky. And the intentionality, the way that we approach problems and try to make change in the world, that's a very, very much different process from trying to forecast. Now, a good forecaster takes into account whether or not some object is movable, right? And then thinks about, well, what are the other people who want to see, who have incentives to want to see either this stay the same or also to try to make change, and take that into account when they forecast. It's almost like strategic intelligence, basically, where you're trying to figure out, if I do X and the opponent does Y, then I should do Z. But if they know that I'm doing Z, then maybe they'll do double Y. It's Bazzini's Princess Bride conundrum, right? And so I think taking all that into account makes people better forecasters, but we should never conflate forecasting with actually making change.
When you talk about members of the military receiving intelligence and putting it in quotes because they're skeptical of it, that dovetails with something that I think we've talked about in the podcast and are talking about in GGI as well, which is integrating forecasting with artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all the different ways technology can bring new information and new ways of digesting that information, getting that information to us, parsing that information to inform our decision making. How do you get people, assuming that there is going to be some skepticism, and it does seem like we're living in an age where there's a lot of fake news and a lot of sort of low trust in information, what ways do you think are the best ways to help people make decisions and also integrate machine learning and artificial intelligence with their decision-making process so that they want to use it, so that they trust the information and integrate it into their lives?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I think I'll try to tackle the artificial intelligence algorithmic decision-making piece first. The principle of garbage in, garbage out still applies. I think if you don't know where the data comes from and if you can't trust the data source, it's very hard to say that some algorithmically produced forecast or input into a decision model is something that you should rely on. And I think people should be really critical about where that comes from. I guess I sort of disagree with your line of thinking in terms of whether we should try to help people become more, I guess, accommodative to algorithmic decision making. There's a huge part of me that says that, follow the psychology literature, which says algorithms outperform humans on a regular basis on diagnosing medical issues, on trying to make a determination of whether a person is worthy for a loan or not. There's certainly some truth to that. Part of that is algorithms are more consistent than humans. They don't eat something wrong for lunch or have their cat scratch them in the middle of a podcast. But
is that what happened?
No. I think that there is a huge piece of this that has been left unexamined. And that's what is going into the model. you can have this most beautiful model that's built and it reflects reality and how things should work. But if the data going into the model is not very good, your model outputs aren't going to be very good. And I can't emphasize that enough, because I think that people tend to forget that when they look at a model and they see a model that is 80% accurate in predicting whether or not a picture of somebody is that person is homosexual or not. One, I don't agree fundamentally with the ethics behind that kind of research, considering that it's a dual-edged sword that people are playing with. At the same time, 80% accurate, you know, compared to what? I think we should ask ourselves pretty deep fundamental questions about whether we should place that much trust in algorithms.
All right, well, that's an interesting question, because in that one, you're talking about essentially teaching a computer to discriminate in a sense, to evaluate people on the basis of their appearance. We might not want them to do that. But it seems to me that one of the things that algorithms could do is evaluate their sources of data. Given, you know, sets of data from the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and Breitbart, it could, over time, learn that the Breitbart data isn't very useful for making its forecasts. That's something, if it were a variable.
Unless it comes into how people in certain regions of the country will vote, and then it may be accurate.
Right, depending on what you're using the data for. But that could be something you could teach an algorithm, at least with enough time, to evaluate its sources of information as well, which is the garbage and which isn't.
I don't disagree with you on that. I think the issue there is, what is the normative benchmark? What is the standard that you're using to evaluate the efficacy, the effectiveness of an algorithm? And here we're using accuracy in forecasting as the benchmark. And there are better and worse sources for that. But there are a lot of things that algorithms are used for that don't have that hard normative backbone to it. And there you're getting into much, much murkier territory and allowing a machine to make a determination that I think ultimately humans should make.
I feel like a lot of the questions where humans are doing a better job or have an advantage is where psychology or knowledge of history or local cultures has a big effect. And then you obviously have to decide, not only, let's say you could decide the psychology of a leader, but even if you understood some of the psychology of a leader, does the leader actually have absolute control, or is he or she, you know, inhibited by certain bureaucratic institutions that would slow them down? So, you know, basically, I feel like some leaders, you might say, okay, we could think of what's the best solution that they should do, but if you can think of how their mental makeup is, you have some advantage in understanding what sort of decisions they will make in the future. And I don't know if algorithms are good at picking that up yet or not.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about the kind of intricate knowledge that machines probably lack at this point. And you're also getting to the heart of modeling and whether or not models as representations of the world are actually good at representing the world, which they purport to do. And one anecdote comes to mind is the giant spaghetti chart that was shown to General McChrystal during the Afghanistan strategy review in 2009. I don't know if any of you have seen this PowerPoint slide before.
Crazy PowerPoint slide with all the different boxes.
Yeah. It's got circles. Yeah. It has lines connecting each of the circles to other.
PowerPoint is a sickness.
To other. And I think the crazy thing about that diagram is we missed the point of it. If you really look deeply into that diagram, what it shows is that fundamentally, with all of these different actors having different incentives in Afghanistan, left to their own devices, even with the United States, ISAF at the time, U.S. forces in Afghanistan trying to do their best to move the needle, because of the weight of all the other actors, you were going to wind up with the status quo in Afghanistan. And 17 years later, I think you could argue that that model was actually quite accurate in representing the world. Yes, it was extremely complex and it probably confused the hell out of every single person who saw it. But fundamentally, things in Afghanistan have stayed largely the same, which is, I think, amazing that they came up with this crazy model. That model was actually interactive, and I think the slide was just a representation of what the model outputs were. So you know, it's a punching bag slide, right? But there's a deep underlying truth there, and that's most models are simplifications of reality, and some of them miss important things, and you just have to have a better understanding of what the model is actually doing.
Interesting question, because I think some very complicated situations can behave in a simple way at a macro level, like thermodynamics, for example. But when you put a lot of different models, data points, or different things into a model, it's hard to have confidence that you've modeled all the important things. So it might come out and say, Afghanistan is not going to change, but I don't know if I need a complicated model for that. I may be able to just say, look, Afghanistan has been similar in these ways for 200 years, and I don't need to know the various actors. Whereas if I put a model with lots of various actors in, I may get all sort of complicated behaviors that don't actually mirror what's going to happen in the world because I forgot a particular group that has some leverage. So I wonder a little bit about, I guess you're saying they got the right conclusion. Their model ended up saying that Afghanistan was resistant to change. So I guess scoreboard on that case. But I'm suspicious of those complex models that you really actually accurately modeled the world.
I'm also curious, though, if that's actually, depending on what the question is. So if the question is, will we have a winning strategy to have stability and peace in Afghanistan and in a way that corresponds with the U.S. interests, probably the answer is no. But would that model show some areas where, are there any regions in Afghanistan where we could have some influence? You know, can Kabul more or less be stable? I don't know. Are there any areas within that whole crazy diagram where you'd say, okay, we can have some positive effect here, and other areas we should just avoid? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it does matter what question you ask, and maybe some of the answers are not palatable for people. And at that point, you should probably reevaluate whether or not you want to go down that road or not. So one smart person that I talk to on Afghanistan on a regular basis, a good friend of mine who is a former special forces officer, this person has repeatedly told me that really nothing, we're never going to get to a adequate resolution of Afghanistan. And part of his thinking behind it is we just can't achieve the end goals, the end state that we so desire, given modern warfare and the demands placed on modern warfare. And that is the restrictions on our behavior. We can't go and systematically wipe out an entire population. That's no longer allowed. And as a result, there may not be space for us to get to the kind of resolution that we want to in Afghanistan. And given those restrictions, we should be realistic about what we can achieve there.
It seems to me that sometimes we think in the United States, because we have the most formidable military in the history of ever, that we can do almost anything. But military power, certainly when it's limited by not being able to commit genocide and things like that, has limits. We can't accomplish everything. And I think that at least politically, we don't want to say that. We don't want to imagine that the U.S. has limits to what it can do, but it gets us into these situations where our goals don't match what's achievable.
Yeah, and there's certainly, the military is guilty in perpetuating that to a certain extent. DOD has the largest part of the discretionary budget. DOD, in their messaging, tends to want to, you know, kind of view the world as something that can be moved with the muscular might of the armed forces. And I think that the more progressive generals, like General Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, and the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dunford, understand the value of getting other parts of the government, such as Treasury with sanctions policy and state and their diplomatic efforts, involved in trying to resolve these conflicts. And I think, you know, one of the things that I took away from my military service was the men and women of our armed forces are unparalleled to an extent. They're unparalleled in terms of their loyalty to America. They're unparalleled in terms of their willingness to accomplish the mission. the kinds of circumstances that we found ourselves in and the conditions that we operated in, I think most people would just have, you know, basically taken their ball and gone home. But the people that I served with, and the attitudes that were, you know, that prevailed on a regular basis, I really haven't experienced that kind of a professional environment since I left the military.
Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to put them in a situation where they can, their goals are achievable. You don't want to ask them to give their all if you don't have to.
Yeah, I guess part of the thinking here is, what are the demands on America as the world's indispensable nation? Yeah. And what are the tools that are available to accomplish the things that America needs to accomplish around the world? And because DoD is the best funded organization, has a rapid response capability, can be attractive in the kinds of issues that are out there, right? You know, there was certainly a segment of the American government that wanted us to intervene in Syria in terms of trying to stop the humanitarian crisis there. And I think some of those same arguments were made during the Rwandan genocide. I think at a moral level, I certainly think that we should have thought carefully about whether to intervene in Syria or not. Now, the wisdom of doing so also requires you to balance against the notion that you can make two kinds of errors in intervening in Syria, right? There's the serious error of commission, which we didn't go down that path. Perhaps we're on a path now to examine the consequences of that if we decide to escalate even further in Syria. But really what we're viewing is a world where most people view the Obama administration's lack of, I would say, use of military force in Syria at a scale that would have been necessary to stop the bloodshed as a serious error of omission. Whereas I think you could argue that our actions in Libya, you know, at first blush were they did what we wanted to do. But now look at Libya and how it's kind of backslid into really, really terrible conditions. Viewed on a longer scale, on a longer term, you could also make the argument that we're made a serious error of commission there. And so I think you have to balance those twin, you know, errors. And if you don't think about both sides of the error, it makes it very, very difficult to fully evaluate whether or not a decision was good or bad.
And so it sounds like what you're saying is, in the military, we don't just have a hammer. We have a really, really great hammer. We have the best hammer ever. So we should certainly consider using it for a lot of our tasks. But there may still be some things that, you know, you don't want to smash. And the, you know, the long-term consequences maybe in Libya were not worth it.
I don't really love the hammer analogy, because the military has gotten a lot better at doing a lot of the things that military as a constabulary force is forced to do.
Yeah.
You know, we're no longer this conquering army that's going around taking territory and doing the things that perhaps were okay a couple centuries ago. We're doing the things that are okay now. And I think for the most part, you know, with the right equipment, with the right training, we're okay at some of those tasks. But we're not the kind of cure-all that America needs to solve all of their problems.
Well, I'm thinking about things like resolving centuries-old conflicts. You know, as a political scientist, I have serious doubts about any outside force coming in. I mean, maybe an army of diplomats, and to some extent, U.S. military is called on to be diplomatic, but I just don't know that that's something that this kind of institution can address, that it's not really the way to go about it. Is that wrong? Do you disagree?
I think the military will always do what the nation asks it to do. I think the nation should ask itself, one, whether or not it's worth it to do those things, and then the second thing is the military the best organization to do those things? And with the proposed gutting of the State Department, a lot of those diplomatic tasks, things that were previously in the portfolio of state and USAID, are going to fall on the military. And I fear what that kind of mission creep, that dilution of skill set, is going to do to large parts of DOD. Now, you could also say, well, look, we're just not going to do those development missions anymore. Then perhaps you could make a rational argument that we don't need as much capability in state and USAID. But I don't see us pulling back from those commitments. For all of President Trump's rhetoric on this, it seems to me that we have basically maintained the status quo in terms of our commitments abroad. And as a result, this whole push to defund large parts of state and USAID, I think, is just completely wrongheaded. And I really hope Congress gets to their senses and puts all of that funding back into the funding package.
Do you think we could see a Rexit? Do you think Rex Tillerson won't last?
It's hard to say. I mean, who knows what his motivations truly are? I think there was a lot of reporting early on about his spouse telling him that he needed to take the job for the good of the nation. And he's quite wealthy, so I don't think that, you know, missing the Exxon CEO salary is really what's you know, bothering him at this point. So, you know, it's like trying to get in the head of somebody like Putin, right? There's probably a lot going on there, and it would be really, really difficult to guess, you know, exactly that the micro minutiae of, you know, whether or not somebody is going to quit or stay in a job.
That's true. It's one of the hardest things to forecast, right, is what's going on in an individual's head. If a decision or an event depends on one person's decision, it'd be difficult to forecast.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can try to kind of break it down into observables and, you know, what are Tillerson's objectives? Have they been achieved at the State Department? What did President Trump actually want him to do? What does he think is best? What are his incentives for staying? What are the things that he can actually accomplish there that he wants to accomplish? You can lay all of those things out, but perhaps, yeah.
And if he leaves, who would be put in? Because I would think if you were in his position, you may be thinking, okay, if I go, what's the next consequence of this? If he, and I think he probably does, I would grant him that he cares about the country and is trying to do what he thinks is best for the country. Because obviously I don't think he's doing it for money. So if he's doing it for the good of the country, then he should be thinking, okay, if I go, who follows me? And what would the effects of that be on the country?
Yeah, and to the extent that he's having an impact on US foreign policy, how much of an impact, he's probably thinking about it on a regular basis of, is it better that I'm here so that I can stop some of the really crazy things from happening? And, you know, do my patriotic duty as an American citizen to be a active participant in our government and try to steer the ship of state in a direction that I think is ultimately going to benefit everyone. But he's probably also recognizing that if he does not toe the party line and, you know, gets frozen out of the process, ultimately he's not going to have that impact. So he may have to go along with some lesser evils as he's trying to maintain his position within President Trump's cabinet. So it's a really tricky dance, and I don't think anybody should envy his position. You know, I fundamentally disagree with many of his positions and fundamentally disagree with many of the Trump administration's positions, but I don't, I guess, you know, have really any grounds to impugn the intentions and motivations of General Mattis, General McMaster, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State Tillerson. All these individuals, I think, are trying to do what they think is best. But that's the funny thing about rationality, is you can be totally rational and still come out with some really, really horrendous, you know, decisions. So, someone made the argument that it would be totally rational for Kim Jong-un to nuke an American city as a demonstration of what he can do. Because then he can say, well, look, I devastated San Francisco. Now, if you don't do what I ask you to do, I'm also going to devastate Seattle and Los Angeles and Portland. And maybe at that point, he would force the world to capitulate to North Korea. That's a crazy line of logic that is actually, if you play out the expected utilities, it might be rational. depending on, you know, how you frame what rationality actually is.
I wonder about that a little bit, because it seems like, I mean, I guess I can make that case, but one of the things is we're not playing a game where every step is necessarily, you know, all your options are necessarily fixed. There's an element of uncertainty of this. So if he nukes San Francisco, and thanks for choosing my hometown as an example, if he nuked San Francisco, then there is a certain percent chance that he just dies instantly. I don't know how high, but probably pretty high. So yeah, he could say, well, I've got to retaliate, you know, I guess it's a third strike capability in this case. He could strike back if the U.S. retaliates against him. But that seems like a very risky strategy for
him. Sure.
Because they could just come after him.
I think Israel had a more sane approach, and I don't remember which it was, the 7-day war, I don't remember which one, but they apparently were considering having a nuke, basically exploding a nuke on one of their own mountains just to show their enemies, if it got to the point where they felt they're going to be overrun, that yes, we have this power, stop now.
Well, that's what Kim Jong-un is doing all the time now.
Yeah, I understand, with underground tests. And at that point, Israel was not confirmed to have nukes, and so their idea was, okay, we'll just blow it up on top of a mountain, everybody will know, and then that'll just be the end
of
it.
Right, but here's the thing. You guys are only thinking about it from, well, external threat. Now, what if at that point, let's say sanctions, whatever new sanctions we put on, and the Chinese start ratcheting down on coal imports, et cetera, really puts the economic crunch on the regime and the million or so people that they need to keep happy in and around Pyongyang to maintain stability. And at that point, if Kim Jong-un doesn't change the status quo, he sees
he dies.
The next 6 months as basically being that this is all I have left to live, and I better drink all the whiskey I can now. So
yeah.
If that's the calculus, if the, you know, expected utility for staying the course is actually really small, then you start gambling about, well, what if I mix it up? What if I change the status quo so that I, you know, have at least a chance of survival, right? What if at that point he sees the chances of me being overthrown are close to 100? It would be really, really hard to make a rational argument to say that it wouldn't be in his interests at that point to do something crazy like nuke San Francisco.
That's a great point. You're saying essentially, if I understand you, that Kim Jong-un is playing what they call in international relations a two-level game, that he's got an international threats to worry about, but domestic threats as well. And I think if we look at North Korea, a lot of what he does has to be considered a reaction to his need to stay in power at home. And maybe a real reason we don't want to have a regime change policy where we put certain kinds of pressure on him, because it might give him a greater incentive to strike out.
I definitely think that that's one way of looking at it. There's definitely multiple levels of interaction that are happening. And for the most part, you can view actions taken by the Kim regime as playing to both sides, right? And at the international level, there are multiple audiences to whatever the Kim regime is doing, whether that audience is Japan or South Korea or China or the United States or someone else. You know, I think you have to take all that into account. They really carefully calibrate what they want to do and how they think it's going to be viewed. I mean, they pay a lot of attention to this in the media. And Evan Osnos wrote a great article in New Yorker, I want to say last week, where he talked about spending 4 days in Pyongyang and talking with his North Korean minders who were trying to parse every word of President Trump's tweets and trying to make sense of exactly what President Trump was trying to say in each of these statements about North Korea. And so there's a danger here, and that's, how much rationality should we assume the other side to have, right? And it's possible.
Do you think Kim Jong-un is rational?
I think it depends on how you define rationality, but I think for the most accepted uses of the word rational, I think he's quite rational.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Do you think Trump is rational?
Yes, I do. I do. I think he has different utilities than most people. And because he's maximizing on utilities that other people don't think are utilities, it may make some of his actions seem to be less than rational, but I take it as a fundamental point that most people are trying to maximize on something. Now, whether that something is good for them, whether that something is good for them in the short run or in the long run, you know, that's not really for me to say. But if you view that, right, if you view people through that lens, then I think a lot of people's actions make a lot of sense.
I take your point, but I think there's also an element to Trump that's impulsive, that has not calculated the strategy very well because he's just not necessarily interested in the facts. So I am not entirely confident that he's a utility maximizer, even on his own self-interested strange utility.
I think he does do some things that are considered to be rather impulsive. Now, you could also make the argument that he can be impulsive and also achieve some of his aims at the same time. So the impulsiveness can be viewed by his base as authenticity, genuineness, unfiltered. This is who he is. Take him for what he is. And that was a chief complaint of Secretary Clinton during the campaign, was that she was not authentic, that she was scripted, that the sound bites and the quotes, you know, trumped up trickle down economics being one that was routinely lampooned by SNL. Those quotes were tested in front of focus groups to make sure that they were properly calibrated for an audience, and they felt that way. And so, yeah.
But I think there's a different type of authenticity. So I agree with you when you're talking about Clinton, but when you're Hillary Clinton, but if I think of somebody like George W. Bush, who I'm no fan of, but I felt like he was basically, I felt like he had a position that he felt strongly about, and that I disagreed with many of the things he did, but I felt like he had a belief system, and he was trying to do what he thought was right, and you know, based on what the people around were telling him. And I think that basically there was a larger picture there. But if you look at something like right now with both North Korea and Iran, and this is actually taking the words from the Iranian president, which I'm not probably supposed to do, but Rouhani was basically saying, okay, if you tear up the JCPOA, if you tear up the agreement with Iran, how are you going to encourage North Korea to go into any agreement with you? You know, this makes no sense. If you tear up the Iran agreement, what are you going to do? Are you going to attack them unilaterally or with the aid of Israel? And how is that going to get rid of their, you know, their nuclear capability anyway? And so there's some of the things that he's doing that are like, okay, I know he has a different ideological background than I do, but I can't see that this is utility. I just see this as some of the positions is just folly. And it's not about, okay, if you're talking about tax policy or whether we should be more federalist or more socialist, okay, I can understand that. Those are different ideological positions. But there are some that I don't see, other than there's always an off chance that acting as a madman or, you know, unpredictable may freak somebody out to the point where they actually acquiesce to you because they're just like, we're just not going to take the risk. I wouldn't want to fight a psychotic person. I'd rather fight a rational person because they probably won't fight. So if he acts psychotic, maybe he's going to get some reaction from people, but I don't think that's a good policy.
I think in a lot of cases, when he does these things, he's speaking to his domestic audience. Yeah. He is less interested seriously in peace in the Middle East or non-proliferation than he is in talking to his base. Like yesterday when he calls Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and threatened to destroy North Korea, maybe he thinks he's improving the situation in North Korea, but I feel like to a large extent he's showing off for his voters. And I think a lot of his activities have to be thought about in that way, not as achieving any sensible international objective.
Yeah, and it's also possible that he's trying to achieve multiple utilities at the same time. So on the JCPOA and how the Iranians would react to getting rid of the Iran deal. Now, full disclosure, I have been a very public supporter of the Iran deal. I think that is one of the Obama administration's crowning achievements. And I wrote a syndicated op-ed that ran in a bunch of different local newspapers that argued that we should give the Iran deal a chance. Now, what kind of utility would that serve President Trump for tearing it up? One thing would be, well, look, he's just threatening to tear it up. So he's getting all the benefits from threatening to tear it up from his base. All those people who go to his rallies and wave around the Make America Great Again stuff, right? And at the same time, he might have a pretty good recognition that these people don't actually pay attention to the news that much. And if the Iran deal just keeps going until, you know, 2020, no one's actually going to know, right? It's the same thing with the Mexican wall. he's now saying that, well, we're already refurbishing parts of the wall, so I'm already fulfilling part of my progress, right? He is so good at moving the goalposts and every single time reframing what other people would consider to be missing his goal or missing what he actually wants to do into a victory for himself, right? And so it's actually on some levels quite brilliant. Now, what the long-term damage is to U.S. credibility and to the office of the presidency, I think it's pretty severe because of how little we can trust what comes out of the president's mouth. And it will take some time for that credibility to return. And it will depend on who the next president is. It could get even worse, right? You can imagine the darkest timeline where we get somebody who is smarter than President Trump and also fundamentally more evil than President Trump and basically takes all of the things that President Trump has done in terms of tearing down the norms of the presidency and the norms of our government and uses that really to their advantage. Now, that is, in my mind, the really scary thing that could happen.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's really undermining a lot of precedents and that you could get someone, even just someone like Mike Pence, who won't violate as many norms, but will, you know, at this point, some of the violations of norms have become Republican Party orthodoxy. And, you know, Democrats get in power, they might do it too, because the other side's doing it. So I think that's really a huge danger.
I don't know in terms of international policy, because I feel like, as we mentioned, there's these two levels. And with the wall, I think his supporters, I don't think most of them actually expected a giant wall of China to be built. And he was simply signaling that he is going to be tough on immigration and he is, you know, not wanting a lot of immigrants in. And so they could say, yeah, more or less, yeah, we wanted a nice, beautiful wall in Mexico to pay for it. That's never going to happen. Okay. But it's clear he's not wanting to make big changes in immigration policy in terms of letting a lot of people in. We're not having a lot of people coming in from Syria or Iraq or whatever. So basically, we don't care about the details. He basically is keeping his general idea, not the exact words. But I don't know how damaging is it in terms of our relationship with Mexico, or will Mexico simply say, okay, we know this guy sort of spouts off to his domestic audience and we'll just ignore that and we still have business we have to do. So we more or less just have to go on and maybe not much changes. I tend to think it's a bad policy, but I don't know what the actual damage is, how quickly it can be reversed. So I think, I mean, you could even look at the precedents of George W. Bush was not very popular internationally in some parts of the world. And when Obama came in, I think the international community was quite quick to switch back to thinking, yes, now we have a person we can deal with. We're happy with this outside of maybe areas like Israel.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about human psychology, right? You can interpret what comes out of the president's mouth in many different ways, literally, not literally, optimistically, pessimistically. Mm-hmm. And so if you're already inclined to be a fan of the president, you can say, well, he is fulfilling his promise and the wall is figurative and not literal, even though
he aspirational.
On a regular basis talked about this, the wall in very concrete terms. And not only that, but also putting solar panels on the wall and, you know, making the wall clear because you don't want somebody throwing a giant bag of drugs over it and killing somebody on the other side of the wall. Right. So I think we can be somewhat forgiving in how we interpret some of that. But if you really, really follow what has been coming out of President Trump's mouth on a regular basis, I don't know that you could make the argument that the wall is that figurative. I think it's very concrete in his mind, and I just, it's terrible policy to do that. I mean, it's not only ineffective, it's a waste of money, and that money could be better spent on the $1 trillion infrastructure plan that's still yet to appear, something that Trump promised that has not been made good on. And
it depends if you have an investment in the ladder company in Mexico, it's a good project.
or tunneling equipment. Yeah.
Tunnel, yeah.
I used to own a 40-foot ladder and I thought I could rent that thing out.
Yeah, that'll do it. So we should, before we get any further, I'd like to talk a little bit about your research, Welton. You actually, as part of your research or connected to your research, you actually helped design Good Judgment's training materials. Is that right?
Yes.
So tell us about, well, tell us about your research and also like how you did that, how you decided what would be a good way to train forecasters.
Yeah. So I would say that much of the training material was already there by the time I arrived as a researcher in year four. So I think taking a step back a second, after 2011, when I joined Good Judgment Project as a guinea pig lab rat subject in doing forecasting, I did that for another 2 years as a super forecaster. And then in year four, I moved to the research team because I had at that point been accepted to the University of Pennsylvania's psychology program. So in year four, we really try to, I would say, improve on the training materials that were developed in previous years, fundamentally remained unchanged in terms of the core concepts. And from there, I think what that got me to think more about was, how do we make people better at decision making? How do we sharpen people's judgments? And that opened up a whole can of worms for me. I started to look more deeply into the actual normative standards that we use to judge reasoning and forecasting and accuracy and the philosophical debates behind these things. So some of my research looks into that. I worked on another IARPA project, which I'm actually still working on this project called CREATE, which is crowdsourcing reasoning, evidence, arguments, thinking, and evaluation. And there, basically, it's an analog to the super forecasting stuff, but now we're trying to improve reasoning in individuals and much more of the kind of open-ended qualitative type work. You could equate it to writing down how you justify a forecast. If you wanted to use a rough analog to the forecasting stuff, but it's much more complex than that. And I think demonstrates also just how much of a philosophical morass reasoning and that ground has become. So that's another area of my research that I've been focused on over the last couple of years. And in thinking about how we improve how people make judgments and how people make decisions, I've focused primarily on what I call high stakes decision making and the kinds of environments that people find themselves operating in. So in that respect, I think I deviate a little bit from the traditional laboratory work, which...
High stakes decision making.
Yeah. So in thinking about consequential things, for example, environmental policy or whether or not we should go to war with another country, those kinds of very impactful macro type decisions that have previously, I would say, been mostly the provenance of political science and trying to really kind of connect the individual psychology and group psychology up to that more macro level. So I've been looking at some of that stuff as well.
Do you think people make decisions differently if they're deciding what to get for lunch than they do if they're deciding, I don't know, a more high stakes issue?
Yeah, I mean, for lunch, that's almost always habit. And the shorthand for that that's been popularized by Daniel Kahneman is system one, intuition. I think it's a little bit more deeper than that. But if you wanted to use a shorthand, that's, I think, adequate for our purposes. Now, when you're talking about making a decision of whether or not to go to war, I think if you read Bob Woodward's books and if you talk to people that have worked in National Security Council and places like that, and you read interviews with presidents and other cabinet members, there is a lot more going on, right? There's just a lot more other factors to consider, and costs come into play much more saliently. And the institutional incentives for other actors, you know, whether they be cabinet officers or, you know, other people who are a part of the apparatus, and bureaucracy comes into play and the incentives of bureaucracies. And there's just so many more factors to consider, right? Yes. At a fundamental level, lunch can be complicated too, right?
Yeah. You're underestimating the cost of my lunch.
If the four of us wanted to go out to lunch, right, and we were trying to negotiate what's the optimal lunch between the four of us.
Right.
Now you've got a
I think groupthink would be a real issue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a whole literature behind group decision making, and that's something else that I've had at least a passing interest in looking at, you know, things like group polarization. And, you know, groupthink is the very popular term. I actually wrote something about how groupthink as a research paradigm has been misused, and we kind of misunderstand what groupthink actually is. It's shorthand for all these dysfunctions that groups exhibit. But in the original formulation by Irv Janis, who I think was on Phil Tetlock's dissertation committee.
Oh, really?
So his original formulation was basically premature closure of discussion because of a need or want to maintain social harmony. Right. So there's actually a lot built into the concept. And in the popular parlance, groupthink is used to explain basically everything that a group does that could be wrong. So there's a very specific definition that's in the literature that most people ignore now. And so, yeah, if I had a dream, a hope, and that one of those things would be to try to change the conversation around what groupthink actually is, and to be more exacting in our usage of that particular term.
So how do you think group dynamics can be improved to produce better decisions? What would you do if you had a group and you wanted them to come to a good decision?
Yeah, I think some of the more research by Anita Woolley, Chris Chabris, and others at MIT, and I think Professor Woolley is at Carnegie Mellon now, I think focusing on a couple of factors. One is the kind of social IQ of the people in the group, you know, how well they can understand and empathize with others in the group, so that you do have a better way of kind of interacting with each other. So, you know, a lot of that research really demonstrates the, I would say, beneficial effects of having more women in the group, and I think more diversity in general. And that, you know, I think Scott...
More women just because of diversity or because they have a higher social IQ in general?
According to the research, this research, they tend to have, you know, population average, higher social IQ than males. You know, of course, you know, we're talking populations here. You
right.
can find lots of males, put them together, who have high social IQ and likely get some of the same effects. And I tend to think that some of the other group work around diversity and Scott Page's work, I mean, this is what's been missing about the conversation about diversity in Silicon Valley, is that there is a huge, huge bottom line advantage to having diverse teams and work groups. And if you really, I think one of the things I was missing from that Google memo was the person's implied norm for what a good engineer is really relied on a kind of weird stereotype of an engineer. And it was kind of ignoring all of the other things that software engineers, software developers actually have to do on a regular basis. And so the idea that you can maximize on all of those very narrow traits that this person put into this memo and ignore all the other things that come into play when it comes to working with others and being good at your job, I think it's a real mistake to try to enforce some kind of homogeny within an organization. You know, I was actually on many different levels troubled by the lack of diversity in the Trump cabinet. I felt that the diversity in the Obama administration was much more of a goal, and something that ultimately led to, it's hard to argue the counterfactual, but just on the face of it, probably better decisions. And so, you know, this is something that I think even good judgment could improve on, and that's recruiting more women into the forecaster pool. The conversations that I've seen recently are typically dominated by men. I almost rarely ever see a woman super forecaster chime in. And
we actually had a case when we had the market, when it was still the Good Judgment Project, of the woman that that both Robert and I know, who she originally used, she didn't use her real name because she thought if she was viewed as a woman that her opinions wouldn't be taken seriously. And I can say I don't think that was the case, but I can't prove it.
I think she was probably right.
But it's relevant that it's relevant that she felt that way.
Yeah.
And you know, and then she proved herself. She became a super forecaster, and eventually we knew who she who she was and have great respect for her. But there's very, very few women in forecasting. And we're trying to add some, but we're still having a challenge with that. And I would assume you had the same thing in intelligence in government. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I think DNI did release a demographic report, and it shows some of the same demographic trends that you would see in other places. So one demographic trend would be that there are fewer women at the top levels of the intelligence community than there are at the mid and lower levels. And a lot of that has to do with women being penalized for having children. And if this country has any hope of trying to get the birth rate back up over replacement, I think a lot of those policies have to change. I mean,
You just allow immigration.
Look, something has to change, right?
Right.
The current path is not sustainable. That much is obvious. And, you know, what's the very definition of insanity is when everyone sees the solution in front of them and refuses to take it, right? And so there's lots of arguments to be made for fixing what's going on. And I think the supers we're eventually going to wind up hitting a question where it would really benefit from having more diversity, and it will make itself pretty salient. And
it's also not just diversity gender. It's also we have a need for diversity in terms of ethnicity, country of origin, you know, all sorts of different areas where language is spoken. There's a lot of areas where we could, where we could improve.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's always salient. I mean, I think that one of the things that really is useful in forecasting is having your assumption and your perspectives questioned. So seeing things from different angles, because you could just miss something if your life experience doesn't help you to understand something crucial.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the primary reasons why I stuck with forecasting for as long as I did was, yeah, accuracy was one thing, and I like to be accurate. I think most of us like to be accurate. But just the value of the conversations that were happening around me and the other people on my team, I'm an original Team 5 alum, like Elaine, who you guys had on a few months ago.
You guys have Team 5 tattoos, right?
I think we were going to get hats or some kind of engraved crystal ball or something, but we haven't done that yet, no. But just the kinds of conversations that we were having in our group. And it otherwise, we would never have met each other, right? So there, I won't name all the other people in our group, but you know, one of us lives in South America and another person lives north of the border and works for a major multinational, and there are a couple of people that live in the Beltway, and you know, I'm in Philadelphia, and we all have different jobs and different kind of really different backgrounds and ages and ethnicities, and we just have a shared interest in trying to make sense of what's going on around us. And with that kind of, I would say, you know, epistemic goal in mind, we really came together, and we still regularly exchange tons of emails with each other. And that conversation is something that I value enormously. You know, it's so easy for us to get locked into these information bubbles that we have. And when you think about, when you start asking, you know, why did person X do Y? Why did Trump voters vote for Trump? Well, if you inhabited their reality on a regular basis, you might have voted for Trump too. So, you know, a huge part of me says we need to do more of this perspective taking to get out more. You know, I've now, you know, we've gone across the country on road trips 6 times. We did the whole Amtrak thing from Philadelphia all the way to Whitefish, Montana this past summer. And I love going across this country because it just shows me all these different things that I otherwise wouldn't have seen before. We love going to national parks and love to travel internationally. And having that exposure, I think, is really important. And without that exposure, you run the risk of, you know, just really distorting your lens.
I'm also curious about empathy, because you spoke about empathy. And I think in terms of decision-making, I also, one of the reasons I enjoyed and still enjoy forecasting from the beginning was that the questions are not just academic to me. A lot of the questions are in areas of the world where the results are impactful. And I'm, you know, the forecast may not change what's happening. Hopefully it would be effective at making better policy. But I think, like, if you if you have some knowledge of the areas of the world, and there are areas of the world could be United States, but it may have an effect. It obviously it shouldn't have an effect on how you forecast, because you should just forecast coldly, not based on wanting a desired result. But when it gets to the actual level of policymakers, I'm curious if policy decisions would be quite different. You know, for instance, if it was about Iran and your family was from Iran, or some members of the cabinet were from Iran, would they have more pause before thinking we want to do something that would really risk military action? You know, maybe that's bad, but I think that that's something that's critical, is having, you know, actually having a feeling that the areas that you're working in forecasting or in policy, that you actually have some vested stake in what's happening.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how having skin in the game would change decision making. On the one hand, you could imagine that if paralysis. Sure, yeah. I mean, if there were, let's say there was a widespread draft and every single member of Congress who had a child of military service age had to send their child into the service, or even they themselves being of military service age had to go in. And now you have to vote for whether or not you or your family members are going to be put in harm's way. That could change how people think about it. Now, that's one perspective. Another perspective could be, well, actually, it might make people harden their positions more, where, let's say, for example, you know, I'm trying not to make light of the situation. You feel kind of strange talking about it in this way. But if you lost a family member in a conflict, you might be more supportive of that conflict, because you don't want that family member's loss to be
lost in vain.
To not be meaningful in some way. And so, you know, there's different ways that the psychology could play out, I think. And I think what we just need more of is deliberate thinking about these choices. And the lack of it is a result of, you know, very much mostly System One rambling that goes on in the 24-hour news cycle, and the fact that the media can only pay attention to one thing at a time. And they've got so much airtime to fill that they'll let anybody on to say anything. So, it's funny. Somebody wrote an article basically that said national security decision-making and decision-making in general would be improved. Governmental decision-making would be improved if we were in the age of people having to write down their reasons and Hamilton 7 type of Madison 7 writing these essays out, basically, right? And to say, here's how I'm justifying my decision, versus what happens now, which is I make a snap judgment, I justify it post hoc, I send out my spin masters out onto the cable news networks, which have no filter for who gets on, and they go out there and they sell this intuitively fantastic sounding decision to my base, my fans, who are also mostly intuitive processors. And this is on both the left and the right. This is not an ideological thing. It's just how we interpret and bring in information that's coming at us. There's so much stuff going on in cable news that we're just kind of inundated with this. And the only way we can process it is just kind of accept it as it comes. And so if you're watching Fox News on a regular basis in there, and you say to yourself, well, I'm just going to trust what comes out of this person's mouth, then a lot of, you know, how you form your reality is with these very, very slippery concepts that have very little bearing in reality.
What's the main thing? If you could give someone who wanted to improve their judgment and their forecasting ability some advice, what's the most important thing they could do to become better forecasters?
I think it's two things. One is do your homework and your research. For a long time, when I was forecasting on Team 5, I would look at the new questions that popped up as an opportunity to learn.
Yeah.
I had no idea who Viktor Orban was before.
Oh, I've learned so much. I completely agree.
You know, before that question came up.
His country isn't right next to mine. I know too much about it.
Oh, so, yeah. We can dive into that later, I guess, if we have time, right?
Yes.
You know, I had no idea what Daniel Ortega was doing in Nicaragua, or any of these really intricate mechanisms for...
I'll be honest, I didn't know Daniel Ortega was back. Like, I thought he had gone, and I didn't realize he had come back. That was... I mean, I feel like I should know about international politics, but like you, I didn't really know the details.
And now via his spouse, right, who's, I guess she's prime minister. So, yeah, there's all sorts of strange things that are going on out there that the mainstream press or whatever media outlet that you look at on a regular basis isn't really covering. And I thought what was neat was if you look at the kind of consumption habits of supers, many supers, when they're doing research on a specific forecasting questions, will go to sites like allafrica.com or EurasianNet, like places that most people aren't reading on a regular basis, unless you're like deep, wonky into that specific area. And getting information, I would say higher quality and more on the ground information in that way, I think helps people kind of cut through the noise that's out there. So my first recommendation would be do your research. Don't try to forecast blindly and try to, you know, well, I'm feeling this way today. So of course the Dalai Lama isn't going to come to the United States or get a visa from South Africa or whatever that question was in year one. Right. So I think the corollary to that is once you've done your research, to really think hard about base rates and about reference classes and how to draw them. Right. So
explain what a reference class is.
Yeah, so reference class would be a grouping of events or concepts or things that kind of look like each other, right? So for example, if we want to talk about dictators and whether or not Bashar al-Assad will remain in power in Syria, perhaps what we should do is to look at the entire population of dictators in the Middle East and just look at how long they've all been around. Right. So there, the kind of assumption is that Assad is not new, is not a new thing. He's yes, might be uniquely evil. He might be uniquely kind of diffident, whatever. But at the same time, the fundamental underlying structure of his dictatorship looks like other dictatorships in the Middle East. And so we can forecast his longevity by looking at the longevity of other people like him, whether that's dictators in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia or other Gulf states or maybe Sisi in Egypt. I mean, there's all different ways that you can draw a reference class, and that's more of an art than it is in science, but it is a good rule of thumb to keep in the back of your mind. And I think it's where, you know, a good example of where System 1 and System 2 bleed over into each other, right? So thinking about base rates for most of the literature is a system two function. It's a deliberate thinking function. But if you do it on a regular basis, regular enough basis, it becomes a habit. It becomes a system one thing that you just kind of default to when you start thinking. So you can train the intuitive part of your thinking with these kinds of deliberate overrides that over time become more natural as you become more practiced at it. And I think ultimately, those are the kinds of things that people need to do to get better at making decisions and making judgments about the world, right? One is get the best information that you can. And then two is process that information properly. Think about that information in a contextualized way so that you're not misled by these false signals that are out there.
It's an interesting point, the dictator analogy. If you're asking, will a dictator leave office for some reason? As a rule of thumb, I've discovered, you can tell me if you agree with this, the answer is probably no. The chance is pretty small. And you might not necessarily think that. In any given situation, you might think, oh, well, there's a reason why this particular dictator might leave power now. But they just stay in power a long time. So if you look at that reference class, you're looking at Syria and Bashar al-Assad, you might say, well, dictators usually don't get kicked out of office. And unless he dies or is assassinated, he'll probably stick around for a while.
But then we would think that Mubarak would still be in power too.
Right. It's not 100%, but it's a rare event. It's a relatively rare event.
And Gaddafi. And so I think it's, you know, we tried to draw reference classes and dictator would definitely fit. But then what was unique to both Gaddafi and Mubarak that they, you know, broke from this mold?
Right.
And why was it that why would, because like right now it's very easy for me to say Assad's going to be around a long time. But at the beginning of the war there, by far the general consensus was this guy's got months left, and obviously that was, you know, wrong thinking. So why did the general reference class fit for Assad but not fit for Mubarak?
Sure. Well, I mean, Scott, Robert told me to give one reason, and I gave him two. Now I'm going to give you four.
Yeah, no.
Sure. You did fine on answering the question, but one of the difficult things is trying to find, you know, the relevant reference class, and basically it's complicated, but it's a very good starting point.
Yeah. So I think there's two other things, right? One is balancing, and that's a concept that we talked a lot about in the Rethinking Training for Intelligence Analysts paper that I sent you guys. I have another paper that I'm the lead author on with Alyssa Berdini, who was one of our very talented undergrads who's in law school now, David Mandel, who is a Canadian methodologist in their intelligence community, and Phil. And we wrote a paper that really kind of questions the underlying assumptions behind using structured techniques to make better judgments. And, you know, one of the concepts that we try to introduce in the paper and that we did flesh out at least a little bit in the Rethinking Training paper is this idea of bias being bipolar, meaning that you can be overconfident, which many people are, but you can also be underconfident in your judgments. You can be too dismissive of base rates, which many people are regularly, but you can be too wedded to base rates as well. And in your example, I think what you're trying to say is, look, you can't just use the base rate and set it and forget it. If you did that, then you would miss these changes to the status quo, like Gaddafi being ousted and Mubarak no longer being in power. And I think there, balancing really comes into play in that you shouldn't hew too closely to base rates when it's unwarranted. And you probably should have some pretty good reasons for not thinking about base rates if you think something is truly unique. So for example, in trying to forecast the probability that we'll achieve interstellar travel in the next 1,000 years, I mean, it's probably pretty hard to come up with a base rate, right? I mean, I guess you could do some kind of extrapolation from like our sending rockets to the moon and things like that, but I don't know what the probability of us being able to visit Alpha Centauri is. I mean, I don't know if anybody does. There might be a physics-related answer to it, but I don't know if there's one that's related to the information that we have available to us. So I think balancing is definitely really important, right?
I think that there's also the, like, in the case of both Libya and, like, you could also say Iraq with the toppling of Saddam. In both of those cases, the U.S. got involved in a major way. They got involved in a major way in the air. So you may say, okay, there are certain conditions that made those situations fall into a different category. You know, so now we're talking about dictators in the Middle East, but where the U.S. Made a concerted, very concerted effort to institute change. And maybe it's not only based on the U.S., you know, the U.S.'s intervention, but, you know, so it's like, okay, you have one set of base rates and then you have another, and you try to look at both of those and say, where does our current question fit among different possible base rates?
Yeah, and I think you're getting at a point that I made earlier, which is not to conflate forecasting with actually making change, right? And so, yeah. You know, there are certainly, I think there were incentives at work that said, hey, we should try to make change in these different parts of the Middle East. And we ultimately acted on that, right? So if you were making a forecast and you were in the government, you're being asked, well, what's the probability that Gaddafi won't be in power next week? And you had access to the plans where, you know, we were going to support NATO on that effort. I think you would probably be, you know, well within your grounds to forecast a fairly high probability that he's not going to be in power anymore, right? Yeah, and I think what you're also getting at is how do we understand change and how do we predict change? And part of the super, I would say the super forecaster like secret sauce is that we got really good scores by understanding how the status quo works. I don't think we quite have a great grasp on change, but I would submit to you that the thing that everyone hates to think about when they think about change is Bayes' theorem and how to take evidence that's out in the environment and integrate it with prior probabilities. But in my mind, Bayes is probably the best way of doing it. And if you have a good grasp of Bayes, whether it's an intuitive grasp or a mathematical grasp, you can do much better than most people who are trying to predict change who aren't using, you know, kind of the Bayes principles.
That's another point that it raises. You talk about it being more of an art than a science. I think one of the things is you need practice.
Yeah.
This is something that you can improve. And we've talked a lot about the importance of feedback. I think we were probably all fairly good at this type of question before we started. But a lot of the ways we got better was by seeing, hey, I was wrong here. Hey, my assumption was wrong here, and calibrating. So I couldn't tell you exactly why I think that Bashar al-Assad is not Muammar Gaddafi necessarily up front, but I started to get a better feel for which is the relevant reference class in a given situation. Is Assad more like Gaddafi? Is he more like Kim Jong-il, for example?
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right on that. Yeah.
So we should probably wrap up. We're coming up. We've been had a good long conversation already. But tell us about your cats.
I have two cats. Me and my wife have two cats. One's named Percy. He's a male gray tabby, and Portia is a little tortie. And they both came from a cat shelter in Washington, D.C. And they now live in Philadelphia, so they've done some traveling.
They take Amtrak too?
They can now, but I wouldn't subject anyone to Portia's howling, you know, if it came to that. But Portia is named after the character in Julius Caesar. And
it's Caesar. I was going to say Merchant of Venice.
Portia is it Brutus's wife?
Could be. It could be. I don't know Julius Caesar as well.
So, and then Percy, his full name is Percival J. McGillicuddy Chang. So if you wanted to get technical about it, but he's actually pretty inbred and kind of a funny cat, but we love him just the same. And I just...
What does that mean, inbred? What are his sides of his...
It's royalty.
Is he a Targaryen? Is he a Romanov?
He doesn't understand cat social cues. Portia finds him quite insufferable, and he walks funny, and he has some health problems, and there are lots of signs that indicate that parents are probably related at some point. So,
and they have 12,000 viewers now, or something like this. This is what I'm curious about.
How do people follow your cats on Instagram? We need an Instagram name for them to follow Percy and Portia.
I know cats are popular, and I know, like, if I photograph...
They're adorable, Scott.
Yeah, I haven't seen them, but I've got to see it. But if I see, if I put a pumpkin on Facebook, I get more likes than if I write, a good article.
Yeah, there's a long story behind this, and I won't bore your listeners because they probably didn't come here for cat conversation, but...
It may help them.
A couple of years ago when Meredith was working at the White House, so... Full disclosure, Meredith was an Obama administration official. She's my wife, and we've been married for almost a decade now. And she was working on the National Security Council as one of the directors for Iraq policy. And while she was at that job, I was in Philly working on my PhD. And so we were separated, and I needed something to kind of fill the space in my life. And so what I wound up doing was creating this cat Instagram. Please follow at Percy and Portia. That's P-E-R-C-Y and P-O-R-T-I-A, if you care at all. But so I started taking pictures of them, posting them on Instagram. They started picking up some followers. I did it some more. I followed some other cats. They followed me back. And before I knew it, they had over 12,000 followers. So they're a thing. They have like exponentially more followers than I do on Instagram, Twitter, anywhere. So, they're celebrity cats, I guess.
It's not just 12,000 other cats following you, like a whole cat community following one another.
there are a ton of cats on Instagram.
It might be.
I know. There are so many cats on Instagram. There's probably more cats than people.
It's like Catstagram. But cats are adorable.
Hey, look, they do fun things. The two of them are, my companions when I'm writing. Mostly interfering with writing, but they're our little animals, and we love them. So,
great. Do you guys have any more questions before we let Welton go?
That's great. Yeah.
No, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on. It was great. I had a great time, and I think maybe there are some other Team 5 members that you haven't interviewed yet. So I think you should get some of those folks on your podcast. I think that'd be great because Team 5 is the best and has always been the best.
I'm open to suggestions. I don't even know who the Team 5 members are by team. So you'll have to help us on that.
Yeah, yeah, send us an email.
I'll shoot you guys a note offline for some other good Team 5 interviews.
Excellent.
All right.
Hey, thank you guys.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. All right, guys. Talk to you soon.